GoLive presents Recorded History with therecordhub.com. 100% Irish and direct to your door.
Hello to you, my recorded historians, and welcome to Recorded History with therecordhub.com. My name is Ed Smith, and this is our weekly gander through the meaningful records of yet another interesting and very gracious soul. Now, this week's chat is a special one for me, I must say. I've been a fan of this man's work and his vibe since the mid-90s, and eventually, and to my endless smug delight, I can count him as a friend to this day. His impact and importance to the Irish music scene is absolutely immeasurable, from the glory days of No Disco to his seminal radio shows Here Comes the Night and The Small Hours on Today FM, to his countless live DJ sets, collaborations, exhibitions, and now short films. His devoted connection to music is an absolute joy to bear witness to, and I think is only matched really by dedication to his homeland of Kerry. He is, of course, the legendary Mr. Donal Dineen. As is the case with so much of his work, it just takes us on a journey. This time we go from Ratmore to the very musical heart of Africa and beyond. It was an absolute joy to hear his story and his choices. So, without further ado, here he is, the great Donal Dineen. Well, the moment has arrived. This is the one I've been looking forward to most, I think. And listen, Donal, I've had Shania Twain on the podcast. I don't know if I've mentioned that.
But you're the
indie alternative to Shania Twain, is it fair to say?
I hate the word indie. I love the word Shania Twain, though. The words.
I am joined by the legend that is Mr. Donal Dineen. Thank you so much. I feel like I'm playing five-a-side with Messi.
Oh, my God. It's a pleasure to be here. Ed, would you stop?
Would you stop? Get out of that. A Cork and Kerry man sitting across the table as God intended. Look, thanks for coming in. You're a busy man.
My pleasure, yeah. Well, yeah, busy man. I do a thing called Backstory where I kind of DJ. And it's really like I've came to the kind of end of that point many years ago. But then I started my own thing and I've built that up with kind of word of mouth. And in the age that we live in where we sort of send each other everything via the moon, word of mouth still works. So it's been really good.
And you're back in your old stomping ground.
Yeah.
You walked in and you said something. You said, it smells like radio. What is that smell?
I can't get rid of that
sweat and desperation.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, I had a really good innings on the radio. I also had a really bad innings not being on the radio.
Yeah.
But that's another story. And this building obviously was where a large part of it happened. And so to me, that never leaves me, because like what I'm telling you about what I was doing last night, that's a very different version of broadcasting. Mm. But I'm still speaking to my audience, and just not sponsored by anybody, and I'm directly kind of taking it elsewhere. But that project continues. So that the part of it that I was here was undoubtedly a very good period in that regard for that story. But I kind of feel like the tragedy is that I'm a far better broadcaster now, and I'm not on the air. If you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like,
yeah.
No, don't be sad.
I am sad.
No, I mean, look, it's a thing that kind of the Irish radio thing that kind of gave me up, as opposed to me obviously giving it up.
Yeah.
But you know, having had such a good innings, it would be absolutely wrong of me to kind of moan about that, because so many people dream about that. My dream came true. But as you know, there's the dream. And, you know, all throughout those 14 amazing years, I had daily people tell me, oh, Dineen, you know.
Yeah.
And but then there's obviously a rare guard action with, you know.
Well, we'll get to that. And I, on behalf of everyone, you're as much missed as you are missing it, I'll tell you.
Oh,
that.
Thanks. Well, look, another thing, Ed, is right. Every time, you know, I'm a shy and reclusive person, but I occasionally meet people, other humans.
How's that working out?
Well, now that I'm back in Kerry, it's less frequent. But I really miss Dublin. I really miss the energy of people and communities and the way it's changing. But I regularly meet people everywhere who say, oh, I was doing this when you were doing that. And that to me is the greatest compliment. That's when I feel best about my life.
You, of all the episodes, I'm not sure what number this will be, but... You're the person that's been name-checked the most.
Really?
Okay,
wow.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, look, another level...
Paul Noonan definitely was here. Like,
yeah, well, look, another level is when musicians say it, because then you have a kind of an act in kind of shaping in some tiny way. Same way that the good baker will contribute to the good painting of the great painter. Oh, that's absolutely terrible analogy.
No, you know, I like it.
I felt that, you know, having so much time on air, I felt like each night was like a kind of a brick, and it was just a big picture. That didn't sit well with the...
you can say it. They're gone.
Yeah, the littlest of big people in the whole station. But it was more like, the thing was, it was really like a project in that sense, that for the people, the Paul, who, like, you know, that man's work is amazing. Like, all these people who are heroes of mine, and they have said, oh, there was a period when you were there. And the idea that they would be just that little bit of help into those kind of brains at that point, that's the most satisfying
thing.
There's
just name-checking two or three, but like, that is,
yeah.
I think,
oh, no, I
get that.
Yeah.
How many.
Yeah, and to be honest, Ed, I feed off that because in lean times, I mean, look, let's not talk about currencies, but it's the most valuable currency. And I do feel that, like, I once had this, when I was kind of teetering on the precipice of leaving Today FM, I just so happens, can I say somebody's name?
You can.
There was a great man who was the Director General of RT, Bob Collins, at the time. So just by a couple of people saying, oh, his sons are into the program, I ended up meeting him, right? And that conversation was one of the pivotal ones in terms of me saying to you, oh, well, my audience is, I'm continuing to do that. And that was the biggest and best advice he'd given me, was that it doesn't matter if it ends, where it ends, how it ends, it will continue if you have an audience, and kind of always think about that. So,
beautiful way to look.
Yeah. So now, as I say, I'll happily do it one-on-one. If, you know what I mean? At the right approach, the right moment, I have a vocational zeal for kind of sort of applying myself to the presentation of music and how I want to convince you that this could make life better. And that's all it's about, really.
Yeah. And I suppose you're, you know, talking about your music, listen, you know, you're here to to discuss your recorded history. And of all the people I've asked this question of, I would have thought you above all, this would have been the toughest ask.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, I have to say, so it's not, I suppose, I'm really picking things because I feel like they are significant moments, because music for me is like a kind of a, I call it OCDD, where I just have to have something the next thing, and it really changes so quickly. And it's about, like, one of the things that life, you know, as tough as it is to live, the one thing that it has, in my case, I've had this thing, music, as a kind of a pattern that I understand, or I understand myself. And I mean, that sounds like, you know, very wishy-washy, but it's how I feel about it. And music is the one thing that I know where I'm going and I know where I've been. And it's something that's always next thing. So for you to ask, or I mean, to say three things, I would be like, what, when today's three things? Or so, and also, like, I'd say in the last 15 years, I've listened to probably, I would say music that I listen to would be 5% would be in English. You know what I mean? And that's just purely because I'm spent using the time that I've got to discover.
But you've probably listened to every other record around the world in English at this stage. So you have to move to new territory.
I've really taken it upon myself to try to kind of, it's like, you know, people who are lucky enough to be able to travel, right? You know, I consider myself in this age to be, I still buy records, and the only thing that I can really afford to do is one thing, and I do it like obsessively still, and that's collecting 7 inches. So like there's music from places, the Caribbean, from South America, and from elsewhere, loads of places, that is not on the digital world. And I get great excitement in that. And again, it's not something you could easily point and go, well, oh God, men doing the, you know, like buying things like that, you know, because that it is a kind of, has always been that kind of digging thing, very male pursuit, but it's changing now. And I think that that's, anyway, for me, that process of doing that online mostly, I spend a lot of time doing that. To pick a few records and say their thing. I mean, these ones were important at the time. So the three that I've
We're off to a flyer. You know, the first one in your recorded history, often argued as the greatest Irish album of all time and one of the greatest in general.
Mm-hmm.
So at Donald and Ian, what is the first record in your recorded
history? Oh, it's, well, God, Astral Weeks by Van Morrison completely changed my life. Not it just took me into another place completely. Probably 2 years into... 3 years into listening to music. So by that time, started off on a tape recorder that had an opening mechanism that would take a child's eye out, slapped hard, And then graduated by just sheer like badgering parents into getting...
So how old were you then when you first...
Once it changed from... I say the change was from Yezu to Yazu, because I was an altar boy one day into God and all his stuff. And then I saw, after the tragedy of Depeche Mode breaking up, I saw Yazu on Top of the Pops and I bought Smash It. Anyway, the next day, and I just said goodbye to the old God and started worshipping the false.
That was it. It had that much of an impact.
Oh, yeah. I was a different person the next day. I mean, the consequences I'm trying to write about at the moment, because I am trying to make a documentary about something that happened in 1986. So, the journey from where I was and who I was, music transformed that journey and sent me in a direction where by 3 years' time, I had graduated to a Walkman. And those were the early days of the Walkman. So you're talking 1981-ish, you know, like, I mean, that allowed me then to, like, not only was I kind of retreating from the world of the farm and all of that with all guns blazing, but by the time I had a Walkman, I was like, you know, retreating from the farm and then going into space.
So it was like a portal into yourself.
Yeah. And Van Morrison's Astor Weeks, I can remember where and when. And from then on, I felt like a different person.
And was it just lying around the house? What kind of records around the house, or tapes, or what was it?
Absolutely no music whatsoever. None. We just had none.
Yeah.
And so that was part of the kind of thing, was that it was my discovery. And I was the one who was like, I am going to get enough money to cycle to Killarney to look at the tapes, and then I'm going to buy one of those tapes. And it's going to be, so it was that kind of obsessional thing. So the opposite of the what happens now with the immediacy of everything, which is something we have to accept, and we're working our way through.
Well, it's come up before in this, and I think, you know, I'll always pitch for Spotify to some regard as regards to the accessibility, and it's opened up artists that I wouldn't have discovered, but I do feel...
I would also pitch those people into the fires of hell.
No, of course, yeah. But as regards, I suppose, for me, discovering music for the show and all that
for
is...
For sure.
That kind of top-level, surface-level accessibility. But I do feel, and I do feel what you're saying here in so much the physicality and the connection that you had with music back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as you say, you know, it was almost... I suppose a trek, a journey that you get on your bike and you cycle. The physical effort that you put in, the emotional investment that you put into these records seems to have dissipated.
Oh, and Ed, look, you touch on something that's a huge issue, much, 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 much wider issue, but it's just the journey of the anticipation and the actual, like, you know, so in that's my life, right? Cycling that far just to look at them 12 miles and cycle home just thinking about them and then cycle again when I had them. And, you know, all of that, right? So I've got a friend, Noel Sumbu. I'm jumping ahead, but my third choice is an African record by William Onyebor, right? And I chose it because that's the beginning of this journey for me, where it became all African music. But a key person was somebody that I know and collaborated with as a DJ, and he's a guitar player from Kinshasa called Noel Sumbu. Mm. And so we'd do gigs together as Parish in various places way back. And
I've seen you, it's incredible.
But anyway, it sort of gave me the opportunity to drive all over the country with Noel and him playing me African music and me like asking him questions, and it got to like I got it was amazing teacher, incredible man, incredible musician, and then at the time a place you know well, we are sponsored by somebody actually, we're by Lucky's Barber in Stony Valley.
That's right.
So here we go. So Lucky, right? Number one, what an appropriate name for this man. But number two, that place was somewhere I'd go regularly for several years, right? Weekly, maybe.
Lucky's in Stony Bend.
Yeah.
Anytime I pass it, on the corner. It's just right inside. If anyone knows Manor Street, it's on the corner.
It's on the corner. Go there.
And anytime I pass it, I look in with such almost envy.
Oh, my God.
Because the atmosphere and the vibe
it's
in there.
It's incredible. Every different culture doing their Friday thing, and it's... And some cutting of hair, a little bit.
Yeah. But it's not even about that.
But I got to a level where I was allowed to play tunes off YouTube, which for me was like being transferred to the great team. You know, I that was like, and so I'd learned so much about, well, I play something, my favorite new thing from Ghana or whatever. And so I'd put that on and they'd be like, oh, not Ghana, no way. You know, the way you'd be like, I don't know what would the equivalent be, but let's not get Republican or nationalistic about it. But so look, that's what was my explanation? That's, I suppose, the journey of music, the anticipation. But Noel, right? His growing up, when he grew up in Kinshasa, 9 million people, no electricity to begin with, absolutely destroyed by the Belgian colonizer. But anyway, if he wanted to hear John Coltrane, he would walk 40 kilometers to hear it once with the guy who had the tape in the other village that way and walk back.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, and he didn't even get to possess it, you know. So like that thing of the ownership thing of everything that we are now, you know, benefit from and are tainted by, you know. It's that thing has become, it's a real problem in one way. It's a blessing and a curse, Ed. But anyway, we better talk about the music.
Sorry, I wish I had 5 hours with you, but your time is against us. But just to go back to Astral Weeks before we move on to the next one. What was it, or what is it about that particular
thing? So music is capable of making things happen that we as human beings, we can achieve it in conjunction with each other, and there's a kind of there's no formula, and it can make things that are kind of bigger than life. All art does that, right? And music has a really unique way of doing it, and it's about individuals like colliding, right? Van Morrison was trying to get out of a record contract, had previously been very kind of, you know, R&B really, and was going down that road.
The brown-eyed girl.
Yeah, but was moving elsewhere. Look, there's a whole other side story about him extricating himself from a contract.
It's incredible. I just read about it. It got very dark.
But then the light came.
Yeah, yeah.
So other things happening. We won't speculate on that, but clearly he's in a place where his mind is opening, right? There's something going on there, right? One key kind of reference which doesn't get written about, which I feel is a big part of it, earlier on that year, 68, the creator has a master plan came out, Pharoah Saunders album, right? And there's a kind of expressive free spirit throughout that with the horns and flutes and stuff like that. Van Morrison must have heard that. That's a personal theory, but if anybody wants to have, check it out, right? So he got, like, Lewis Mernstein was the producer, steeped in jazz, brought people who had played with Charles Mingus, Eric Dolphy. The key people are Richard Davis, the bass player, and Connie Kay, the drummer. I mean, there's key people everywhere. The flute player. flute, my boat. But so there's a collision of these phenomenal virtuoso musicians. They're not session musicians. I mean, look, the history of soul music is the incredible session god musicians, right? But this is a whole other level. It's the people who the greats of jazz would play with. So there's, you know, so much written about what happened and how it happened, but it literally is him coming and playing with them without instructions. It's as quick as kind of fire, you know, and it is fire. And that's the thing about, there's no formula, but when it happens, it's incredible.
Well, the planets align.
Oh, God, it's an explosion, a planetary explosion. And so Richard Davis, the bass player, double bass player, became effectively the student leader. Now studio leader, band leader, session leader. And he's on record as saying that Van Morrison never spoke to him and never gave them instructions and was really upset because he's not used to that. It's all plan, program, all, you know what I mean, jazz, you know, whatever you're doing. So for it to collide in that way, it's spectacular. So it's
astonishing.
It's, you know, one of the greatest works of art. It's the story of how it came together is the story.
I'd recommend anyone look into the slightly nebulous backstory to this. You know, it gets to kind of some murky places for Van Morrison, but he did extricate himself.
Yeah.
And then as a result, this is essentially his first album.
Sound of him setting himself free, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, Ed, product placement alerts. Backstory is the name of my night in Dublin.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll get to that. No, don't worry.
You just said backstory there.
Sorry, backstory,
you said it again.
Is it backstory? Is it? We'll get into the backstory of backstory.
Yeah.
At the front story of this podcast.
No,
I want to rattle on. First of all, is it true that you're... Well, I don't know how true this is, but...
No.
It's on the internet, so it has to be, as I say. Your first live experience was a Shanaki in Sliv Lucre. I read that somewhere. You went to Shanaki as a child, and like that was your first line. Yeah.
Well, in actual fact, it's something I would have heard without knowing what it was. So, but actually, the first voice I heard was this incredible singer in the choir in the church back in the God days, and his name was Dick Wiseman. He was just three brothers short of the most amazing trio, but he had this high kind of voice, and I guess 3 years old or whatever. I can really remember looking up and kind of feeling like the voice is coming from...
Even at that young age?
Well, that was like, it moved me so much. And then the next kind of thing was seeing my dad dancing at the stations. There's a thing called stations that happen in Kerry.
So we're from near each other.
Yeah.
Outside Mill Street. You're Rathmore.
Hands across the
path. Which part of Rathmore? Because it's...
There's two Rathmores, neither.
I have to say, I'm not even from Mill Street, but I have to say Mill Street because
we're outside of it. Yeah, no, it's on the border. I mean, it's the one place where we can kind of go across the tracks over the river and through the border in a minute.
Yeah.
But hearing the music, so that was the first thing, but it wasn't until I got my own thing going that I really changed. And then look, we can move on to...
With your second record, I have to say, and this is odd considering I did ask you to pick your three.
Yeah.
That I was a little surprised by it.
Sure, I'm surprised myself. I'm still surprised.
So your second choice in your recorded history, I don't know why that little laugh was there. It is a great record. Dolan Dean, what is it?
It's Unforgettable Fire by U2. Yeah. Again, we're talking about capturing periods of time, capturing moments. And like music for me, it has changed all through my life. And when I said earlier that I know how to kind of map myself, as well as there being great opportunities and good times, there's been lots of bad times. And music is kind of the golden thread. It's like the constant. Unfortunately, I got to a place where I couldn't listen to music, and now that's not the case anymore. But I've gone that far with it, you know. Mm. And if aged 11, somebody said, there'd come a point where you won't listen to music, I'd be like, well, or you'll be responsible for Armageddon. I would have said, the chances are I could do that.
The latter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
B. So music kind of, but some music stays and catches you and changes you in a much bigger way, right? So 1985 is when it came out, Unforgettable Fire. There's a thing going on with that that makes sense when I think about what's appealing about music. And to me, it's the sound of music. It's kind of like this sound. Sound is, I think we live in the age of sound. As you know, it's one of those things I feel that we've experienced it grow and develop and become even more sophisticated and enormous and vast. And at that point, the collision of Brian Eno and U2, I think felt like a big kind
so
of...
So this is their fourth album, and they'd worked with Steve Lillywhite for the first three.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the band were kind of getting a little stuck in the sound that they'd created for themselves. They'd been recording the first three, obviously, in Windmill Lane.
Yeah.
And they felt it needed... change it up a bit. And this is the record I think that is the most pivotal in their career, really, isn't it?
And so it just so happens to be sonically great, you know?
Because they recorded this in a lot of it...
Slane.
Yeah. Because they got out of the windmill and they broke free from, metaphorically and physically, from what they felt was holding them back, I suppose. But Lanois, of course, is a big part in this.
Well, that's the next... What I was going to say that another... So they knew who they were going to and they knew who they worked with. In both of those cases, Daniel Lanois and Brian Eno, they had both invented sound worlds together and separately that were kind of like, I would be still referring to those. In fact, in this very building, I would have played a Daniel Lanois and Brian Eno album. It's called the Apollo Soundtracks. We can't put in a fourth one. But anyway, I do recommend it as a kind of a way to understand.
Well, that ascent landing.
Yeah, that's it. Apollo Atmospheres and Soundtracks.
Astonishing, yeah.
So Lanois and Brian Eno bring that sort of sonic cloak to the table. So, of course, when they left Windmill, it's a real sort of sign of how the recording process can shape a sound, you know. And, like, again, for somebody who sounds so obsessed, I very rarely listen to music in between places anymore. It's dedicated kind of research time preparing for something or just thinking about something and then going to it. And then I keep up that record buying business. I'm always looking for the new releases still.
So are you always very forward? Is your
it's all momentum
forward.
Is looking
very forward.
Because there's water and there's music. And if the water... I'm very impressed that there's free water for all the staff here, Ed.
Look, someone has to pay for it. Whoever's hocking it up the stairs.
I'm going to blow that fact out of the
he's
water. I'm going to drink
he's
all
the jug
this water.
Into his bag. Well, if anyone deserves a free glass of water.
They're what they did together was immense. I'm kind of influenced also by the fact that, and if anybody's listening who was at Croke Park in 1985, right? So by that stage, I'm 15. I've seen Elton John the year before, after the Shanachie, right?
And Shanachie, Elton John, you too.
Dick Wise and Shanachie, Elton John, you too. But there was other stuff in between. I was desperate for music. I went to Mill Street.
Oh, yeah. That's how desperate.
Yeah, I did. I went to Mill Street to the Star Ballroom to see the host. Yeah, the Horselips, kind of the version of the Horselip. Anyway, look, there's many diversions on the road.
Did you cycle to Cork then from Retmore?
I never cycled to Cork. I did cycle to Mill Street though.
Yeah. Well, come on now, that's 10, 15 minutes.
Easy.
Oh, look at this.
All right. So, but I got to go to U2 in 1985. And that was a look, can I again preempt forgiveness here? A zeitgeist moment, Ed, right? You know, the meaning of that cultural moment of huge import that had kind of reverberations outside the country. I felt like I was at the center of the world of music for a moment. It was like, it was unbelievable. So it was called a sort of homecoming, that tour. And it was all around that. It was like winning 10 World Cups, you know, as in that feeling of pride, song called Pride.
Yeah.
But, and what a kind of, I mean, yeah.
Well,
and
for me, similarly, I went to see them in Parque Cuive now. 1993, I think it was the Zoo TV.
Oh yeah, I mean,
to this day, it's the greatest live event I've ever seen.
Still loved it at that point. Yeah. Massive drop off the cliff.
So where are you at now with you two?
At the bottom of the cliffs, more.
Yeah. So what's happened for you? That's
oh Jesus. I mean, look, there's stuff that I've worked on with people and been very significantly whatever. That if I heard it, I would just again. It's just a momentum that I can't go back to things. Okay. I kind of feel like, yeah, I've got problems, Ed, and
99 of them. Well, do you know what? If you don't mind, let's just dip into your life. You've left Rathmore.
Yeah.
You're in DCU studying communications.
No, I was in the civil service for a few years.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, and after leaving law, I should tell the joke that I left it. The only reason I should have stayed doing it would have been to qualify so I could sue myself for refusing to do it.
You were doing law where? In Cork?
Yeah.
Wow.
UCC.
That's very similar to myself. I'd signed up for UCC law.
Oh, yeah.
And then I saw the communications in Angel Street, the brochure, yeah, whatever they call
we
it, perspective.
Similar,
yeah, but yeah. I'll lay down my thoughts that maybe you had a more productive path. But look, so you're in DCU.
Yep.
You're studying communications. Can I, if you don't mind, because time is here. The No Disco. So No Disco, Colm O'Callaghan was the producer of No Disco. He was a friend of yours, was it? How did it come about?
Yeah, in college in DCU, there was another amazing Donald called Donald Scannell, and I was as obsessed with music as he was. He went to San Francisco. He discovered all these free sheets. He came back and he was like, Deneen, we're starting a magazine. I was like, what? How? To fund that is how I started DJing. He was like, we're DJing in the bar. What? And I didn't even know what that...
In DCU.
Yeah. Hmm. And he had a little box of records, and that's he pushing me into doing that. He was like, you do the photography, you do the writing. And so we did a thing called Dropout, which was a dropout of the college magazine. And so him being the incredible industrious person that he was, he'd go around town and put them out places and just opening doors. And there was two writers at the time, Jim Carlin and Colm O'Callaghan, both of whom were writing for an Enemy and Melody Maker. And that made them gods in our world, you know.
Of course.
But they were open enough to go, who are these pups? And what are they doing? And so
this is 92.
Thereabouts. So that led to them writing with us for us, and that led to Colm telling me, "Look, I'm putting in a proposal for a program. You'd be into this." And I'd be like, "Oh yeah," thinking it would be, you know, behind the scenes, and I was absolutely horrified when I discovered that he wanted me to do a screen test, and like, just for research purposes, that screen test should definitely be made available to the Museum of Natural History. Are you joking?
You haven't seen it since?
I haven't seen anything.
Have you
since.
Not watched back any
Never,
of it?
Nothing.
Really?
Ever. Ed, you know me. I'm the most...
I know.
Cannot deal with that stuff. But sometimes, some point in my life, maybe on the last day, I'll go, you know what? Me being like that.
Well, I've been looking at some clips.
Oh, yeah, I can.
No, it's okay.
Talk about them.
We'll move very quickly. But I want to talk to you about this. Just, I want to say this, I suppose. The impact that No Disco had on the music-loving community in this country, I would put it on a par in the same wheelhouse as MTUSA, the late, great Vincent Hanley.
God, thanks.
It was the only show in town, really.
Well, that could be bad.
It was just, And I think you're, and again, you're going to squirm even further here, but.
Oh, God.
I think it was, you know, you would have created a lot of the visuals yourself if the songs themselves didn't have a video.
It got that way. Yeah. So it has this 3 years of me doing it, and then, God rest her, the amazing Uni took over. There's not a day that I don't think about her and where, you know, like when I was talking about a journey earlier about how this bright star's journey was
such a beautiful soul.
But I want to actually mark that because it is something that, you know, we're very privileged to continue these journeys, and I am. So I had 3 years. Initially, Cullen was right there with me, and he was so brave and so, it was a lamb to the slaughter, but he was so good at just like...
But you were so good, though.
But we had a very, very different dynamic that really, just really worked because... Because I totally trusted him.
But music presentation up until that point, I suppose if you're living in two channel land as I was, he was top of the pops.
Yeah.
Then there was that. It was snub. The beatbox on a Saturday.
Did you ever? There was a thing called snub TV. There was a few markers that for me was like, oh, that like kind of, I won't say inspired me because I didn't intend to do it, but it was more that they kind of like, that's the way to do it. Mm. And it, I think snub TV was what it was called on Channel 4, but it's more like, naturally done, you know, and to get it natural is really hard, and to get it natural with, you know, a news crew, which is what we were working with, was I couldn't watch it
but
again.
You were there to service the music, you never got
and then what was really interesting was Cullen then moved on to better, greater things and has made amazing work, and I got relative control of everything, and that's when there was a big change in what I was, and I was listening to Giles Peterson on the radio tapes every week, driving up and down to Cork, and I was like, I want to be able to represent music from everywhere, or you know, and that's what made me make these little
videos.
But
you transferred that onto the radio,
that became the radio. So Audio On was this section in No Disco, which was like the Aphex Twin or some other, and it would get mad complaints, of course, you know. And Anton, who I worked with, who was an integral part of the production, like he was brilliant because he would definitely be going, "What is this?" You know, and I'd be like, "It's music."
Trust,
But so I mean, look, it got me onto the radio, and that was the dream. And you know,
that was 1997.
Yeah, and I got
part of the very first day of Today.
Yeah, and also there's about like 5% of me in a reeling in the years from 1997.
Yeah, of course there is.
There you go.
You're the man of the year.
That's just about where I want
to get onto your third record, but record 3 in your recorded history, we could do an entire episode on this.
Yeah.
It's an astonishing character.
Let's do a 3-week podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Why not?
Okay, it's William Anya Bohr, and it's called When the Going is Smooth and Good. I'm going to try to sum this up in 3 minutes, right? So it's like, if you want to hear like, a holy man predicting all of dance music in 12 and a half minutes in the 80s, this is the song, right? So it's kind of like, it kind of like, it's like chapter by chapter goes through what's good about dance music in the future, if you know what I mean. So it's a man who is like a preacher. He's an industrialist. He won African Industrialist of the Year.
Of the Year, Nigerian businessman.
Died age 70, 2017. There's never been anybody like him. He won African Industrialist of the Year for making some flour
But he had his own pressing plant for the records.
His own pressing plant. Oh, that's...
That's my alarm. I'm going to turn that off.
He had his own pressing plant. He had his own world. He made his own world. And he created this kind of spiritual dance music that has never, ever been bettered. And as I said, you know, like for me, that was the kind of at the beginning of a journey deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper into African music, music from world music. Now, he sings in English and When the Going is Smooth and Good. Like, so again, maybe the reason that a lot of my listening
it's
now...
It's glorious. I was listening to it again this morning.
There's one of the most incredible things to put into a song is an argument of sorts, you know? And he has this back and forth about when the going is good. Just speaking back and forth.
Same in Fantastic Man, isn't it? Where the conversation is that he goes, I tell you, you're all gorgeous like, all the time. Yeah. Why don't you tell me?
Yeah.
And then it cracks into that incredible course. You're a fantastic man. Yeah. So I would recommend, first of all, for anyone who doesn't know anything about William Anya Bohr, there's the Fantastic Man documentary.
Oh, yeah, that's a good
It's only about 33 minutes.
Yeah, that's a good
And it does the best it can.
Yeah,
kind of capture a very mysterious and intriguing figure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's he's again, you know, a holy man, and like Nigeria has been like a hotbed of culture and music, and he is like, you know, when you see people like him, I often think that our heroes in the West, let's call it that way, for a long time were so lazy with those, you know, because he's doing it all.
Yeah.
And he's not just doing it all. He's making things to make him, to allow him to do it all. And it's glorious music. Like, honestly, you know, if I was just, I mean, I didn't even touch on the music, as I said, that I've been collecting and over the last 10 or 15 years. Hopefully I'll get to share it on the radio at some point.
If I have anything to do with it.
But that, I think if you wanted one example of how, you know, all of the kind of kudos and respect and blah, 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 and palaver that you kind of go about European and American electronic music or any type of music. And then you look at something that's so layered and so powerful and so pure.
And he just turned his back on it entirely.
Yeah, and was kind of very reluctant to put it out. And it was through David Byrne's Luakabop that it came around. Like, I heard it first in a Caribou DJ set.
I heard it first through the Nigeria 70 compilation.
Wonderful compilation. Yeah. But like, to bring it back around full circle, like, what happens is, just that idea that, like, you know, we were talking earlier about how music gets made and how things are produced cheaply and you can get them quickly and all of that stuff. But then there's a whole other dimension to music that's just...
Let's talk about that now then.
Yeah, yeah.
If you want to, because I know you've got to cycle out the door. Backstory. So what are you working, what is this that you're working on?
So for the last 7 years, I've ran a night in Dublin called Backstory, and it's really kind of like a collector's collective, because... I also give space to young DJs. Like I was saying earlier, it used to be a very male domain. That's changing, and it's really good for that. And there's a whole new power generation. Last night we had a girl called Alice Ogboa, and just bringing some kind of fresh energy into a place that is thrilling to see in this country, as well as people who are as deep into digging for records as me. So I follow them and they follow me, and it kind of happens within that space. So the name was chosen as a kind of a tiny homage to the fact that dance music has existed since recorded music has been around. And there's this very narrow kind of British European kind of thing that I kind of grew up through of like, oh, dance music came from these parts. Now Detroit has a
Chicago
good
argument. And all.
Yeah. Well, no, those places, again, two black cities, Chicago and Detroit, definitely have claims to be the originators. But I'm talking about like the people who made dance music in the 1920s and the 1930s. And I'm fascinated by all that stuff. So Backstory is a kind of a version of that in the shape of a dance in a rowing club.
And and just before you go again, this document, you're working on what sounds like a very personal documentary at the moment. What can you tell us about
it? It's called, I can tell you that I've written an essay for Winter Papers, and I'm turning that into a documentary. I've lucky enough to get the Kerry Film Bursary, so I've got a small budget to make this thing. And it's called Save the Last Dance. So it's about the death of my dad in 1986, and he was a set dancer. When I was saying earlier about music taking me away, our relationship was the thing that suffered the consequences of that, because it was as soon as I discovered music, I was like, hey, stuff your farm.
Oh, yeah.
I'm listening to John Lennon.
That put a wedge. Do you think that put a wedge between you? How old were you?
Not think it did, you know. So
you were 17.
I was 16 when he died, but this was around 11. So it was awful, because I really provoked that situation. But anyway, he on the night of, I was studying for my leaving cert, my oral Irish, and the night he died, he came in from Cadbury's. We hadn't spoken in a while. He was going, changing his clothes and going to the Celtus house where he was a set dancer. This was his life. He was farming and set dancing were his two things. And he would normally change his clothes and just get out there quickly because there was dancing, sets to be danced. But I heard him, you know, his shoes were definitely shod for sound, so I heard him come towards my room, very unusual. Came inside, hadn't seen him for a long time, had never been there. And he asked me how the book's going. I was taken aback and so, you know, it was a beautiful surprise. And he put two bars of chocolate on the bed.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and within hours, my uncle was at the door saying, your dad died, in the act of dancing. So several years later, I mean, it was absolutely traumatic. Several years later, 15 years later, I'm at Glastonbury at very late o'clock DJing, and I have to get my records 8 miles from sort of the other side of the car park, two bags of records. It's heavier than a pen drive. I nearly give up several times. There's the odyssey about this trip, right? I finally get there, put the first record on. And that the first time I go, hang on a sec. He used to cycle from Rathmore to Newmarket to go to dances.
Wow.
Park up the bike, never drank, never smoked. Dance, he had this energy for dance that was his reputation, as well as being a great dancer. And then I'm looking at myself and thinking, hold on a sec. There's a lot more about us that I didn't feel before that I now realize. It's just skipping a very different beat, but like still anything for the dance. So that was the beginning of what now is going to be this little film about how that his dance that ended that night, how that continued. So that's
beautiful.
I have to tell the story now. So,
to tell it.
Yeah. So now it's So back in Kerry, and I'm putting a lot of time into writing and hoping to write a book, Ed. So. I have to
watch this space.
Yeah.
And we'll get you back on the radio, Donald.
It's a pleasure talking to you.
And listen, I know you're scooting out the door for backstory this afternoon, is it?
Yep.
So, Donald Dineen, on behalf of myself, I know you're going to hate this bit, so I'm going to make it quick. But the significant role that you have played for, nearly 30 years in introducing so many people to sounds they would never have heard.
Yeah.
And to do it in such a modest, kind, and I think organic, and genuine, sincere way is such a rarity.
Yeah.
That's what makes you so special. So I want to thank you for all that.
Oh,
not just,
like getting dizzy.
Here comes the night, another Van Morrison reference. The small hours, I was there for the wake of that here. Downstairs.
Yeah, like I say, I wish I knew then what what I know now, I wish I'd applied in terms of how to deliver it. But hopefully you'll chance again. Ed, it's a great look to me. I thanked my lucky stars every day. So for when I was able to do that,
and so did we,
and still do. Oh, right. Thanks, Ed.
There you go, Donald Dineen. Thank you for sharing your recorded history.
My pleasure, Ed.
Yeah. So there we have it, and there he goes. Just some of the recorded history of the iconic and heroic Mr. Donald Dineen. Have a look out for the next incarnation of Backstory, as you'd expect. It's a powerful, powerful experience. Anyways, I really hope you enjoyed my chat with Donald and the insight into some of his old favorite records, and that you'll join me next week and every Sunday after that. If you want to check out any of Donald's choices, or indeed anything at all that might tickle your eardrums, especially I would recommend Mr. William Onyebor. I would absolutely love it if you did so by way of our splendid sponsors at therecordhub.com. Without them, I am nothing, I tell you. I am nothing. Dust. Meaningless. So, do check them out. They are a wonderful outlet for any record that you might feel the need to get. Therecordhub.com. Next week, I'm in conversation with a genuine rock zealot, a man who has worked alongside pretty much every great imaginable. Yes, the master himself, Mr. Don Was. I've been Ed Smith. This has been Recorded History. Now, all you have to do is hit the old subscribe button and become a weekly listener. But above all that, subscribe to yourself. Because frankly, my dear, I do give a damn. Good luck. Go Loud presents Recorded History. Hosted, produced, and researched by me, Ed Smith, at Go Loud Studios. The show was created and executive produced for Go Loud by D. Reddy. Our series is proudly supported by therecordhub.com, your local Irish and online record store.